Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick, and today we're going to be doing our CISSP, and specifically, we're going to be looking at retention policies and data security. We're going to take a look at, you know, policies that dictate how long we can keep stuff around or how long we should. We're talking about media, as well as hardware and personnel, and then we're going to look at our data security controls and setting up baselines for those and different ways that we handle our data. Like it depends, is the data at rest? Is it in transit? That's going to change the way we handle that data. And here to help us with that is Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
Good to see everybody, even if it is only virtually through a camera lens. But still, glad to have you here nonetheless. Let's talk a little bit about appropriate retention policies. When we think about retaining things, right, as Mike was saying, we're thinking about keeping things around. How long do we need them? What kind of things do we want to keep? You know, if you own a home, you go through this every year in theory, at least once a year, right? You got to go clean out the garage. We tend to call it spring cleaning here in the U.S., although seasons are becoming a little more muddled, maybe harder to figure out when that is, at least for us here in sunny South Florida.
That's why my garage looks like crap.
See, there, you missed that whole thing. That's why. So, you know, when you go through and you clean up, you figure out what you want to keep, what you want to get rid of, and, you know, you put stuff off to the side, and you focus on keeping the things that you want, and you reorganize, right? And so, generically, the idea is the same. When we think about information, think about assets, you know, do we keep things forever? You may be one of those people that will say, hey, I've got to keep that file from 1925, just in case somebody may want it at some point in the future. Guilty as charged. That would be me, right? I have every email that goes back 20 years in our organization, right? I'm the repository of information. But, you know, the reality is it's important to figure out how to keep the things that are relevant, but also then securely get rid of the things that we no longer need. And along the way, we have to figure out how long something should be kept for, under what conditions, and with what focus in terms of data classification, categorization, and secure usage. So retention is all about these things and really thinking through this. You know, we know that we need ultimately to drive retention something that we refer to as governance. And we've talked a little bit about GRC activities generically in prior episodes, some of our prior conversations. Governance, risk, and compliance activities are how we often refer to them. Governance specifically is really the idea of applying policy to a problem and then managing to that end. So governance is all about making sure we do the things we need to do, driven by the specific policy and then procedures that implement it to align us with business requirements. That's what governance is all about. And so establishing retention and establishing archiving and establishing the thought process around information management is really governed by, or, well, without meaning to say it twice, I will say it twice. The concept is governed by the application of the thought process of governance, right? So governance really helps us to figure out how to do the things we want to do and to ensure that we're doing them according to the rules, the stipulations, and the thought processes we've laid down. So understanding where data exists, understanding how to classify and define data, archiving and managing data, these are all functions that information governance and archiving policies would help us to drive and ultimately to manage. And so we want to be thinking about these things. Building ultimately effective overall data retention policies is as much about understanding what is the value of the data as anything else, but equally important to what is the value of the data, it's also about making sure that we understand how long data stays relevant, how long data is important in the organization. You know, we may, for instance, in the United States, we typically have from a financial record standpoint for government entities as well as for private companies, we typically have a 7-year window where we have to keep information around for tax reporting purposes, things like that. If you are in a private company, not publicly held, and you're not divulging financial information, you still have to keep those records for about 7 years because the government, when you pay taxes every year, may come back and audit you and want to see that information. So we have a built-in retention policy there that is approximately a 7-year window, right? 84 months. So we can look at that and say, well, okay, if I have to keep records for 7 years, am I going to store them somewhere where anybody can get to them? Am I going to store them in a place that's on site? Am I going to store them off site? Years ago, this would have been a physical conversation, right? Would have been boxes of records in, what they call them?
Bankers boxes,
right? And bankers boxes, right? And you would have put them in file folders and, you know, labeled them by month and by year and whatever. These days, while you still may have that, reality is a lot of this data is probably electronic today. And so you're going to store it, and it may not be in a storage facility. It may be in a data storage facility that is now digital, right? So we're thinking about storing it on the network in maybe a SAN or a NAS, or putting it into a secure file storage solution that a third-party vendor may sell us, cloud-based today, for instance, so we may pay somebody to archive and store the data for us. Are we going to encrypt the data? Are we going to store it unencrypted? Are we going to have access control that stipulates who does and doesn't have rights to see the data? Is the data stored in a form that is easily accessible so we can use it all the time? Is it stored in a more archaic form, one that's harder to get into and access, but is more secure because it's in long-term storage and we're not really going to access it very often? So we may compress the data, store it in a zipped or compressed format of some kind, and then encrypt it, and then as a result of that, make it harder to use. But as a result of making it harder to use, it's also more secure. So we have to think about these things when we think about retention and we think about archiving, because ultimately, it's these conversations that help draft the policy or help shape the policy. We've talked about this before, and I want to make this point clear for all of you as we're going through this now. Policy should be a direct result of aligning with business requirements in the business. In other words, if a business requirement says we have to keep data for 7 years, let's have a policy that deals with retention. That's going to be a direct match, a one-to-one correlation. If we don't have a policy in the business that says this is how we're going to retain data, then we're clearly not doing something correctly. Because we have a requirement in the business that says I must retain data for, in this case, 7 years, right? And so if I have requirements that are unmet, that are unmanaged and unrealized, I don't have policy. If I have policies that are not linked to requirements, I may or may not be doing the right thing. And I'm never going to want to be one to suggest that policies are not good whether we link them to requirements or not. I'm simply pointing out that policy for policy's sake is not the same thing as policy to support business requirements. And there is such a thing as having too many policies because they may get in the way of you doing your job because we don't really have a reason or a driver for that policy to exist. And this is something else that's important that you want to think about as well. How do we link? How do we require and figure out how to manage policies linked to business requirements? How do we identify them? One of the key things that we have to think about doing is involving stakeholders in the conversation around not just business requirement gathering and understanding and identifying of business requirements, but then linking that and distilling that into policy. Stakeholders, in other words, are going to be that critical bridge, that voice of reason in the wilderness that helps us understand and effectively to define not only clearly what requirements are, but how to link them to policy in a meaningful way. When we create a policy, we should, in other words, run it by the stakeholders. Mr. or Mrs. Stakeholder, does this clearly articulate, does this clearly capture, does this clearly represent what the intent of the business requirements are that we are talking about? You know, in this case, data retention, secure data storage, secure data archiving, and secure data access. And if our policy captures that, we've done a good job, and they should be able to understand that. If it doesn't, then maybe we need to go back to the drawing board and figure something else out, right? Because that's going to be important as well. So want to be thinking about that. We should have, in other words, common objectives that the policy maps to, but the policy also has to be understood at a level that anybody in the organization is going to clearly get what the policy is trying to do. If the policy is so confusing, policy is so kind of, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, out there, right? It's just very unclear. Then if the stakeholders don't understand it, it's a pretty good bet on our part that the business users are not going to get it either, and they're not going to understand the value of it. And we've probably all found ourselves in positions where we've been asked to do things, and we ask the logical question, as all people do, because typically that's how most of us are wired, which is, well, why? And then if we don't really understand the why, we're very unlikely to buy into the idea that the thing, whatever it is that we're doing, makes sense. I have this ongoing conversation with my children in this regard, right? Why are we doing this, Daddy? Why, right? And, you know, as an educator, as somebody who teaches for a living and consults and talks to customers for a living, this is what I do day in and day out. I spend most of my time answering the why question. And, you know, after many, many years, I'm no better at it than when I started, but I'm a lot more patient, right? So we do have to understand, ultimately, that if we can distill down and answer the question why effectively as a litmus test to figure out whether our policies are spot on, we've nailed the policy. If the policy clearly articulates the why, it's mapped to the business requirements, we know we've got a good policy. If we don't, probably need to go back and rethink that a little bit, tighten that up a little. It's always a good way to think about that. So we should have record retention policies. They should be clear, they should be articulated, broadly communicated, widely available, and spot checked. We've talked about the value of auditing to understand whether something is being done aligned with what our expectations of it being done actually represent. So keep that in mind as well. You know, who needs access to the data, as we talked about? Do access requirements change over the retention period? Does the technology used to access the data change? This is one of the big things that catches people off guard. We keep data for 7, 10, let's say 15 years. Is the access control mechanism that we're using the same? It may or may not be, right? That's probably not going to change. But here's something that will. Is the operating system that we're using on the computers that we started with 15 years ago going to be the same as it will be at the end of that retention period? Absolutely not. I mean, not normally anyway, let's put it that way. So if that's the case, have the applications that are going to be part of that process changed? In other words, if we 15 years ago used Office 95, Word 95. Remember Office 95? The good old days, right? Office 3X, Office 3.1, or you know, something like that. If we used that version of the program to create and craft the data, and now fast forward 15 years, we're using Office 25, 2012, or whatever it is, and it's no longer going to recognize or access the data in that format, we have a problem if we haven't thought through that. Do we have a copy of that software? Can we use that software from an archive to then load the data and access it? Or has somebody along the way gone in, accessed the data under the appropriate change management, confidentiality, and integrity controls, updated the data format to now be used with the most recent version of the application that will be used to access it at the end of the life cycle, and then stored it successfully again, ensuring all the confidentiality, integrity, and availability controls are still in place? And obviously change management becomes very important in this conversation. If we're not thinking about these things and not doing these kinds of things to drive this conversation, we're going to have a significant problem. Because the problem will be that from a backwards compatibility perspective and an access control perspective, we're going to be at different places. Access control is probably going to still be inherently available, but backwards compatibility and application reliance is going to be shot. We're not going to be able to get into the data. Or the format is no longer supported. If you remember several years ago, not actually a little bit longer than several years ago now, but you know, back, let's say, 10 years ago or so, we made the switch in Microsoft Office from the DOC or XLS or PPT format to, you know, DOCX, PPTX, XSLX. That's a mouthful to say without getting that one wrong, right? We added, in other words, an X to the end. Now, we didn't just add an X to the end of the data extension. We actually became XML aligned, and our data format is now XML friendly, and XML effectively is fully supported in that program. Well, that's the way the industry went. That's where everything has gone. So that makes a lot of sense. But it's not that we're not supporting the old format. But if you're using a really, really old format, we may no longer support that down the road. And that could become a problem. And you may blow the integrity of the data. You may breach confidentiality by trying to change the data 15 years from now into a format that will work. And that can be a problem if it wasn't done the right way along the way. So very important considerations to think about here. It's not just a matter of throwing data in a box, putting it on a shelf, and dusting it off every so often to make sure it's still available. There's a lot more to it than that. CISSPs have to focus on these key areas. We, as the professionals that understand the liabilities associated with this, have to focus the organization, in other words, not just on the policy, but on the process and procedure that has to be implemented to support the policy over the long term. This is what we do, and this is where we exist in terms of the value we add. Key areas to focus on: media, hardware, personnel. Does anybody in the organization still understand that data 15 years later? Is anybody going to know what it is and how to access it? I mean, this is also a potential issue. This happened around the turn of the millennium, where we went from the 1990s to the 2000s, and everybody was worried about whether or not data would translate. There was that whole issue, right, the millennium bug, but there was also the use of old data formats, you know, Pascal, Fortran, COBOL, et cetera, and putting data into those formats in midframe and mainframe systems 20, 30, 40 years ago made a lot of sense because that was the flavor of the day and everybody did that and it was fine. Translating that into newer data systems that are now web-enabled and are now taking those midframe and mainframe computers and putting them on the web, in effect, to access data through middleware can cause disruption and concern about data integrity and data use. That's a separate conversation. It's not a conversation for now, but I'm just pointing out to you that that institutional knowledge in people's heads, right, that we don't write down because that's the thing we often miss with documentation. If Fred was the only person in the entire company who understood that, and Fred retired 10 years ago, and it's now 15 years later, and we need to access that data, and it's in a format that nobody understands, you may not be able to use that data. And so as a result, you've broken the availability constraints around that data, even though you didn't set out to do so and you had controls in place that safeguarded the data, but effectively availability has been compromised. Not because of anything you did on purpose, just because you didn't plan for the fact that when Fred leaves, somebody needs to capture that knowledge and understand how to apply it to the system going forward. You may be able to call Fred up and get him back, but Fred may also not want to have any part of that anymore, right? And as a result, you know, you may have a problem, because if you can't find another Fred, you may not be able to use the data. So what would you do? You would call Fred's or Us, right? And you would then get a Fred, right? So just keep that in mind and be aware of that, right? So data retention policy is obviously very important, right? So we want to make sure we have them, want to make sure we draft them. There are all sorts of data retention policy templates out there you can look at. The European Union has a real good one. The European Document Retention Guide from 2013 is a user guide you can use to figure out how to format one. There are many local municipal solutions for states and municipalities within the United States that are their own versions of this. You could Google to find them. The Employment Practices Code from the UK, November 2011 is when it was drafted, gives you guidance on how to do this. There's many, many examples out there. You know, the idea of being able to search the internet or the World Wide Web today to find information is not new to anybody. And hopefully nobody that's going through these discussions with us is going to be surprised by the fact that we say, hey, why don't you go out and search for that on occasion? Because there's going to be so much out there that by the time you actually go and figure out, hey, I want to find that, there may be a thousand new things and you may want to get the most recent information. So we may point you to that at various points just because it's going to be the best way to keep up and get the most timely, the most accurate representation of that information. So just keep that in mind. Plus, it's fun to say. Google something, right? All right, so in addition to going out and finding that information and thinking about retention, we also, as Mike pointed out in his opening comments, have to think about the value of what we call a baseline. So let's start by talking about what a baseline is. A baseline is effectively going to be a configuration, but it's a special kind of configuration. A configuration is a representation of all the settings that would go into effectively making a system look and feel like we would like it to. So if I say I want a Windows 7 laptop with Windows 7 Enterprise, I want to be able to have the latest security updates and patches, I want to run Office 2016 on it, I want to have Adobe Acrobat on there as well, because you know, I may need to be able to use the Adobe product. So if I put those things on there, that all becomes part of the baseline. It's part of the configuration for all the system information and all of the software, the applications that run on top, and all the security settings that I need in order to be able to effectively make that system do what I want it to do. You know, in Windows, we can look at basic hardware and system configuration in several ways. We could go into the control panel. We can look at various tools inside of Windows. You also can use the msinfo command, right, to be able to bring up basic configuration information in the system. You may want to use winver, another Windows command, to be able to go in and to be able to see the Windows version and the security software, patching level in terms of service packs. We can look at Windows Update and go in and see what patches have been applied to the system. We could look at the programs area to see what programs are installed. You know, there's a lot of different things we may want to do, right? So gathering all that up and putting it into a configuration that we can then use and manage is what we would call a baseline. Having all that together, usually taking some sort of copy of that, so we will document that and write it down. That's where the configuration management database and the CI, the configuration items, come in that we've spoken about with change management and configuration management. But the baseline itself is usually also going to be not just a collection of settings, but typically it could be done either through some sort of capture of the information in the state. So we may create a template or create some sort of snapshot that we can use to then deploy or use to be able to move the system back and forth between various states. Snapshots are good for that. They let us time travel. We may clone the baseline system, get it into a state that we know we're going to want to use it from. Cloning means to make a copy, so we may do something like that. So there's a lot of different ways to get a baseline, but ultimately the goal is that baseline becomes the standard that we use to reproduce the system to get the configuration and all the settings right. If we automate that process, it takes the human element out of the mix, because once we get it right, if we then capture what is right and we use an automated process to reproduce that, chances are good we're going to be a lot less likely to effectively make a mistake and to configure the system incorrectly, thereby ensuring, hopefully, if it's done the right way, that the security we need in that baseline that was built in is going to reproduce itself every time we make a copy. This is one of the most important elements about what a baseline represents for us. It's effectively, and you can think of it this way, as being the first line of defense in the defense in depth architecture. Because if we can really think about standardizing the configuration of a system and reproducing it as often as necessary, but not just doing that, measuring ongoing compliance with those settings by looking at the system over time and seeing whether the effective settings in the baseline are continuing to be applied, continuing to be observed, and continuing to be used, or has somebody modified them? And if they have, has that change negatively impacted us? And if it has, how do we fix that? Baselines are good for this as well. We would call this continuous monitoring, configuration monitoring, and then we would talk about remediation. So we would look at effectively whether the system is compliant with the baseline or not, is the term we use over the long term. And if it drifts, if there is a delta, a gap that has been experienced, we can then change and remediate that, putting it back to the good or last known state, which is effectively what a baseline represents for us. So we want to think about considerations associated with baselines. Think about all the things we've talked about in terms of how they're used and why they are important. You know, which parts of the system are we going to configure and capture in order to create the baseline? Are we going to look at applications as well as the hardware configuration? Are we just worried about the hardware, not worried about the software? There's different ways to think about doing this, right? So want to be thinking about that. What level of security should the baseline aim for? Is it going to be, as we said, an all-up baseline for everything, including user access control on the system? Or is it just focused at a configuration level and access control is done separately? Really just depends on the nature of the system and what we're thinking about. Should we apply the baseline throughout the entire organization? Or do we have different baselines for different purposes? Desktop, for instance, versus a server. We're going to have very different baselines for those because they do different things and they use different operating systems. And as a result of that, they will look and feel differently. We traditionally don't put audio drivers, or at least we don't have a need for them, so we tend to remove them on servers unless we're doing streaming media or you're building yourself a really cool gaming system, in which case you definitely need audio drivers on the server. But if you're not doing that, right, if it's just going to be a file and print server, there's no reason for audio drivers to be there, because if you put them there, they potentially lead to a liability, right? Somebody may find a way to use those to exploit the system. So when we talk about something known as hardening the system, right, as part of the build process, we would harden by stripping out all the things that don't necessarily need to be there. So all the unwanted or unneeded services, all the bloatware or the, you know, the software that vendors may provide that may or may not be appropriate for use. That's the polite term, by the way. We call it something else, but we won't go into that here. But bloatware, right? There may be applications you don't need. So for instance, the standard template may say, well, let's deploy Office and Adobe Acrobat, like I was saying. But really, on a server that's a file and print server, there's absolutely no reason to have a full install of Office, and you probably don't really need Acrobat there either, because you're not going to be accessing data and reading it locally on that system. You're simply going to be archiving and storing it and serving it up to people who will have access to those programs locally on their desktops. So you want to think about all that. The less you put in a system, the higher the security profile can become in terms of the hardening of the system, and therefore the more secure potentially it will be. We talk about attack surface reduction, ASR is what we call this, and hardening is all about ASR. It's all about attack surface reduction. Yet we know historically, and those of you that have been doing this long enough should know, that while Adobe makes a very good suite of products, and I don't want you to take what I'm about to say the wrong way, the use of certain Adobe products can lead to additional security complications in the system, right? And so the use of things like Java, the use of Adobe products like Flash, as one example, may lead to additional security concerns that we have to spend extra time mitigating and extra time managing through. If we can remove those from a system in order to harden them, because we don't have a compelling business reason to put them there, it's going to make our lives a lot easier, and ultimately it's going to make the system more secure. So, you know, be selfish and just say, well, I don't want to work as hard, and get rid of the stuff you don't need. Whatever motivates you is fine, but the point is this is exactly the kind of thought process we need to engage in. Because if we don't have the right kind of baseline, we don't harden our systems, it's going to be very hard for us to get out of reactive mode, right? Constantly chasing after that system, constantly patching it, constantly worrying about vulnerabilities. We're never going to be proactive. We're never going to be out there in front of it managing all the other things we got to do. Instead, we're going to constantly be firefighting, as you often hear the term used, or reacting to that concern. So baseline protection and baseline configuration management and compliance is a very important skill for the CISSP to master and figure out. We often create catalogs of baselines, or images, as you may hear them referred to sometimes. Depends on the kind of technology you're using. If you're using disk imaging to put images into systems and automate deployment, this will be a catalog of images that you will create and simply use, but those images are indeed considered to be baselines. So you may use Windows Deployment Services, what we call WDS, old school, OG form of that. Remember RIS? Right?
Yes.
Remote install services. Right? So you may use RIS. That's an oldie but a goodie. Not around much anymore unless you happen to play with NT4 and Windows 2000 on some occasion. But RIS and or WDS back in the day. You may be ghosting. You may be using Altiris. Right? There's different software platforms out there. System Center Config Manager. Mike and I were having that conversation just before we got started. So, you know, whatever your configuration management solution is, that's where your baselines are going to be. That's where you're going to store them because that's where your images are. So you're going to be looking at that kind of software platform and tying those skills in to manage it. Remember my admonition to you earlier, SAT vocabulary word, by the way. Remember my admonition to you earlier, right? Where I said to you in one of our earlier discussions that you need to partner with people that have the skills that you need if you're not an expert in this technology. If configuration management and baselines are just not your thing, and that's okay, there's nothing wrong with that. If that's not you, you better just find the people in the organization that know how to manage those systems and work with them to integrate security into those baselines. Make sure patch management is happening. Make sure you're stripping out the hardware and the software that you no longer need on those systems. And by doing that, you're going to create a more secure and more robust way of managing your infrastructure. To that end, we want to talk quickly about two terms that are important: scoping and tailoring, right? Not the tailoring that you think of when you go to the tailor and they adjust your clothes for you, but it's close. But let's talk about scoping and tailoring, right? So scoping is the idea of providing, through the thought process that we use to manage, right? Providing an enterprise with specific, or a business, with specific terms and conditions on the applicability of controls. In other words, we have to make sure that we are able to give context, which is really what scoping is all about. Give context to the organizational thought process around what controls we're using and why. So scoping is really about creating that context and understanding how to answer the question why, if you want to think about what scoping does, right? When we think about tailoring, tailoring involves an element of scoping. We're kind of taking the scope, the context, but we're now narrowly focusing it tactically so that we can actually apply the controls that are specific to the need, and we can then communicate effectively as to the who, what, when, where, and how. Notice I left out the why. Who, what, when, where, and how about those controls and the importance of them. So tailoring is really about narrowing and focusing on the tactical elements of what we're going to do to implement, whereas scoping is really more about the strategic thought process and answering the question of why, creating the context. And if you can marry those two thought processes together, we really hit all the highlights, right? We get the who, what, when, where, why, and how, the five W's and the H, but we get the thought process that is more high level in the organization, more strategic about context and need, and then we get the tactical conversation with tailoring and the focus to make sure that those controls are implemented in a way that they not only are business aligned, but they add relevancy and they ensure that we then are able to understand what we need to do. Right? So when we think about scoping and tailoring, we want to look at two specific areas that may be helpful to you. Some practical real-world examples I want to share with you quickly. We're going to throw up a quick web page for you, or actually two, but we're going to start with the first one here, which is, again, something from NIST, and we'll just zoom in just a little bit so you can see that. And on the NIST website, we are talking specifically about the Security Content Automation Protocol, commonly called SCAP, as you can see. And what SCAP allows us to do is to really focus in on automation of scoping and tailoring needs and concerns in the business to try to figure out how to create these baselines and work with them in order to be able to apply them in the inside the organization or in the business. So this is one practical real-world example of scoping and tailoring that NIST has provided and put out there. Now, SCAP is not new. SCAP's been around since probably 2009 or so. So it's been around for several years at this point. Goes through iterations every so often. But the website, as you can see, talks about validation, content specification, and all the things associated with it. Another area that we should look at quickly, which is another website Mike's going to help me with and throw up here for us, is coming to us not from NIST, but rather from SANS. And you can see the CIS, the Critical Information Security, Critical Security Controls, currently in version 6. They go through revisions every so often. Thank you for zooming in there a little bit. They go through revisions. We're currently at version 6. And the idea is this is a list of the top 20 critical security controls. They're broken up into typically 5 categories or critical tenant areas. Offense informs defense. So the idea of being able to think about having a good offense and having the defense kind of be linked to that. Prioritizing the need in the business and figuring out what controls are important, having metrics to measure against, using continuous monitoring and automation to be able to scale and to scope and tailor controls as needed. And you'll see there are 20 controls on the list. Mike kind of scrolled up and down real quickly, so he was showing them to you. But the idea with these controls are that if you go out and take a look at them, and, you know, randomly if you just look at a couple, things like boundary defense there, CSC number 12, data protection number 13, wireless access control number 15, application software security number 18. You get the idea. These are all very important elements, and we probably have a need for all 20. But the reality is if we're not doing things with web-related services, we may be able to bypass that control because maybe it's just not important to us. So this is another example of the concept that we can apply by looking for external guidance to figure out how to scope and tailor.
Another great episode there, Adam. You know, we looked at baselines and really kind of took it to that next level, combining, you know, looking at baselines and scoping those and tailoring those down. A couple of great resources we can use if we want to dive into that a little bit further. And then back to the beginning of the episode when we were talking about retention policies and some of the things that I actually hadn't thought about. You know, we were used to putting stuff away in a box and putting it on a shelf, and now everything's going out to the cloud and different ways of storing information electronically in the cloud or locally. But what about the software I used to create or access that data 10 years ago? Can I still access it? So great information there. Appreciate that, Adam. Remember, if you guys ever want to attend one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email. We can get you in touch. cadam@itpro.tv. That's going to do it for this episode. So signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
And I'm going to be here next time because we have a retention policy that stipulates that.
He's going to be here for 7 years.
I will be. We'll see you soon.